Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Yo, what's going down, everybody? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecracks Movie Podcast.
We're Show Me the Meaning with Ryan, Austin, and Riley. Everybody, we're Show Me the Meaning.
We are Show Me the Meaning
with Austin, Ryan, and Riley. All right.
Woo. This podcast is all about family. In case that's anybody right. wanted to, this is it's always been, always has been, always will be about fucking family.
And that's why we're talking Fast and the Furious today. We're not talking Birdcage anymore.
This is Fast and the Furious, right?
Because what franchise better exhibits what family is than Cons robbing actually there's probably a case to be made for that, but we'll talk about that another time. First we got to talk about what we're talking about today. I'm Austin Hayden. I'm joined by the Show Me the Meaning crew. We've got Ryan.
What up, film fans?
And we've got a special guest this week. It's Riley Anspa. What's up, Riley?
Hi, thank you guys for having me. I'm so excited.
Thank you for coming.
Okay, so
appreciate it, Riley.
So Riley, like if you were just meeting someone for the first time and you were at Soho, you're at Soho Club,
oh
all right?
My God.
And
oh my God.
Yeah.
Okay.
Soho Club. And Holy someone is shit. Like, okay, Riley, give me the elevator pitch on Riley Anspa. Can you give us who and what is Riley Anspa?
Well, I mean, like, how long is this elevator ride? Are we going one floor? Are we going 10 floors?
It's a super fast. It's yeah.
It's four and a half. It's the Willy Wonka elevator. I mean, shocking in this town. I'm very different. I mean, no one's ever seen anyone like me. I'm an actor. I'm a writer. I'm a comedian. And so I think that's what really separates me from the crowd. So that's what's pretty exciting. I do a little bit of everything, and I mean, like, this is something that's been true about me since I was conceived, is I am annoyingly obsessed with anything Nathan Lane touches or is in.
Okay.
And hell so yeah. that I when I told people I was coming on to talk about this show, they're just like, you get to talk about The Birdcage for an hour? I'm like, sure do. So that is such, yeah. I mean, elevator pitch is like all of that plus Nathan Lane.
Nathan Lane obsessed. Okay, yes. Absolutely. How many times have you seen The Producers is the question, right?
Oh, I mean, I couldn't even count. That and this movie, I feel, I was trying to think about like the first time I saw this movie, and it's the same with The Producers. Like, I feel like I have always seen it. I have always known it. I can't remember a time where I didn't have it in my brain.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, if people couldn't pick up on the hints so far, we're going to be talking about the 1996 classic farce, The Birdcage, directed by Mike Nichols, written by Elaine May from the amazing improv duo of Nichols and May, adapted from the Franco-Italian film, My French is Fucking Horrible, But I'm Going to Do My Best, La Cage aux Folles.
Yes!
That was good.
Starring... Okay.
I have no idea.
I mean, for someone who has a PhD in French philosophy, his French should be a whole lot better. But, you know, well, that's all right. That's neither here nor there. But it stars Robin Williams, Nathan Lane, of course, Gene Hackman, Diane West, Calista Flockhart, Dan Futterman, and Hank Azaria. Basically, in this classic farce, what you get is gay Miami drag club owner Armand and his partner Albert pretending to be straight in order to impress their sons, in-laws, to be. But the kicker is that this soon-to-be father-in-law is not just anyone. In fact, he's an ultra-conservative U.S. senator who founded the Coalition for Moral Order. And in the end, of course, we get a film about acceptance, diversity, artistic freedom, and the power of family. So before we start packing or unpacking this film for all of its themes, let's go around and get first impressions. Because Riley is Nathan Lane obsessed, and because this was her film choice, we're going to start with her. So Riley, this is
honored.
What we did. What was it like? Now, since you've always already have seen this film, you might not remember the first time, but what's the first impression of The Birdcage on you? And then what's it been like kind of revisiting it? What was it like the most recent time you saw it?
Yeah. Okay. This movie... I remember watching it And bear with me. I had the same first impression with this film as I did with There's Something About Mary, in the way that it's like there are moments that, like, I know are supposed to be laugh lines and like big old comedy beats, but that made me weep, like simply just cry. And my first impression of, I mean, it's like you have Robin Williams and Nathan Lane, and already I'm just like, I'll do whatever it is, I'll watch it. But like, I think what is so, what struck me the first time I watched it, and what strikes me every single, and I've seen this movie, I know every line of this film, I've seen it more times than I can count, is how, for such like, you know, a 90s stereotype role, like Nathan Lane, especially, it's so human. And so, like, he's such a clown, but he's, like, a tragic clown. And it's so, I mean, it's just, like, it's heart, he's heartbreaking. And, like, that, I just remember is very striking to me. And I think, like, if there wasn't that element to this, it wouldn't, in my opinion, it wouldn't work as well. Because it, there's such a groundedness that he brings. Whereas it could have just easily been just like, you know, super slapsticky, super, you know, whatever the entire time.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then I watched it again two nights ago with my roommate who had never seen it before. And so it was just fun to go back, fun to get, you know, it's like when he comes in as Catherine in drag, like to hear her just gasp, like not expecting it. Like, I like to get to experience that for the first time with her was super fun. I mean, then of course, I mean, it's, Hank Azaria, it's tough.
We'll get into some of that.
100%.
Yeah, I didn't share it with you two, but I did just post it, and it's, we'll probably post a link or we'll tweet it out. Remember to give us a follow at SMTM_POD. We'll tweet this out. The title of the article was it came out 5 years ago. So it's actually, the film's 25 years old, but this article was written 20 years ago. And it was like, the film should be #problematic, but why it holds up. But it does talk about some of the maybe over-the-top caricatured performances, and does talk about, you know, appropriating drag culture and should this be a problem. But then the author ultimately says, but it still works. And why was this film important for popularizing gay culture, bringing a kind of, for lack of a better term, a healthy gay couple into people's living rooms where they had problems, just like every other couple have fucking problems, but they're still monogamous and they love each other. And why those things were so important in 1996, where a large majority of states in the United States had bans against homosexual unions. So it's also important to kind of remember the time of this film. Anyway, we'll put some of those links down below because there's actually like a lot of stuff, and we'll tweet that stuff out. So remember to follow us. But Ryan, what about you, brother? First impressions, and then what's it been like on repeated viewings?
The first time I watched it, it was after I was going, like in college, I would go through directors I liked, entire filmography, and I one time did Mike Nichols, and I watched this towards the end of his, you know, of me watching all his movies, because I really love him, and you had said it for really well, Riley, about how human his movies are, and that's like the overwhelming adjective I would use on his whole filmography, and they're all so different too, and really cool genres, and really unique too.
Yeah.
I highly recommend everyone go see Working Girl and Carnal Knowledge. Yes. and obviously The Graduates, you know, an undisputed Graduate, masterpiece. Yeah. But I'd heard people always talk about The Birdcage and how funny it was. And then I finally saw it later in life, and I loved it. It was because it's such a tightrope walk of a script where this easily, I mean, it is cartoonish in a lot of ways, but it easily could have been so silly to the point of mocking in a real fucked up way. But I think, in my opinion, it fucking works because of Elaine May's awesome version of this script, which is, like we said at the beginning, you know, a remake, kind of, you know, or modernization, I guess you'd call
adaptation.
It. Adaptation. Adaptation. Yeah. Sure, we'll call it that. Of a French, was it a play or was it a movie? I haven't seen
it. So it's a stage play, and then it was a Franco-Italian film. But yeah, the play is like 73, and the film is like 78.
They did a revival of the musical with Kelsey Grammer as Armand in like 2014.
All right.
Yes.
So anyway, yeah, I love this movie, and we'll get into it. But my favorite, the scene that really encapsulates it to me is just Gene Hackman in drag walking through and then singing We Are Family. Like, I'm like, like that's like kind of what you're saying too, Riley, where it's a funny moment, but I'm like, oh,
like this, you know, man with a, you know, stone heart has like kind of like, oh, like he's learned something today and has a good message. I love this movie. So that was my first impression.
Yeah, so my first impression, it's so funny. I've only seen this film twice. The one time when I was a fucking teenager and then now. And the first time that I saw it with my mom. And I didn't remember much about the film except for it was, for lack of a better term, you know, very camp and very flamboyant. That's all I remember. If you would have asked me about The Birdcage, that's what I would have said. I would have been like, oh, I don't remember. I just remember Nathan Lane and Robin Williams. I didn't even remember that Calista Flockhart, Gene Hackman, Diane West. I didn't remember anybody else. Hank Azaria. I didn't remember anything. I just remember those two. And I remember their performances being big, and I remember it having heart, but I remembered it being really fun and kind of like Priscilla, Queen of the Desert is how I would have thought about it. And then I remember that my mom fucking loved it. And I remember her laughing her face off watching it. And that's what I remember. Huh. So that was my first impression of it. It's through the eyes of my mother, you know, and we grew up in the theater. Like I don't have a memory of time when I wasn't on stage or involved in the theater, right? So for me, this was also like a very sort of important piece because it was just a film about people in the arts, right? So that's another reason. So I remember it through my mom, you know, her eyes. So then watching it last night, it was really kind of fun because I got to kind of put meat on the bones of this skeleton that I had carried with me for all of these years. And it's fun. It's interesting. My partner did come out at one point and was basically like, is this a little bit caricature-y, you know? And I was like, okay, so there's a lot of stuff written about this. So I started digging, reading things. I was like, is this, there have to be things that are commented on about some of these performances. And obviously we live in a time now where we're trying to be so careful with representation. We're trying to hire queer actors in queer roles. And we're trying to not appropriate drag culture for certain other purposes, et cetera, et cetera. So I was like, there's got to be stuff written about this. So then I started reading about it a little bit. And I was like, okay, so there's actually some really interesting commentary about the lasting legacy of this. But the one thing that every single article, even the critical ones, could all agree on, that it still was an important film, regardless of if there are things that we would say, hey, you know what, maybe that wasn't perfect, but it was so important for what it did for bringing this community, this world, into the living rooms of the everyday American, much like somebody like Gene Hackman's character, who's like a representative for, you know, the ultra-conservative American kind of Christian personality type, or the Tipper Gore, we've got to censor everything type. Like, he's kind of an amalgamation of those things. And how it is important to be like, hey, guess what? I know you have these presuppositions about certain people that you might not be familiar with, but you too are part of the family, right? And so there's kind of, I don't know, there's a really sweet message. I will say I did think it kind of ended on a weird note. The ending kind of just came out of nowhere. Like, I thought, because it was a farce, I was expecting a little bit more, like Gene Hackman's wig was going to fall off and the news reporters were going to chase him, or they were going to, like, something. I was waiting for one more, like, foil in the plan, and that didn't happen. And then all of a sudden the credits just start rolling, and I was like, wait, what the fuck? I was like, okay. So I was a little confused. I was like, that kind of snuck up on me. It felt a little anticlimactic, but overall, obviously enjoyed the film, and there's tons to talk about here. I think it's also interesting that Chivo was the DP, so there's stuff we can talk about in terms of the setting, the lighting, how it was actually shot with some of the, like, the longer takes. And then, of course, I think just set design is fantastic, costumes, all kinds of stuff we can talk about, not to mention fucking performances. So we'll do that, but of course, we gotta pay the bills, so, you know, let's do a little bit of selling our souls a little bit.
Yeah.
All right, but before we continue, you know what we got to do. We got to give a shout out to our awesome sponsor, Storyblocks. Look, Storyblocks is the complete stock solution, providing an unlimited library of over a million plus royalty-free, high-quality video, audio, and images through cost-effective subscription plans. They have subscriptions for every budget, so you can choose a plan that works for you based on the selection that they offer. And they also always have a constant, expanding, changing rotation of stock footage to help creators tell their unique and authentic stories. Restock is their commitment to increase representation in stock media by hiring creators from marginalized communities to create content that is more reflective of the diverse world that we live in. I use Storyblock. Wisecrack uses Storyblocks. Use freaking Storyblocks. They got everything you might need. Soundtracks, they've got images, they've got videos, they've got effects if you're using fancy graphic stuff. Head over to storyblocks.com/wisecrack and you can learn all about what they've got to offer. That's storyblocks.com/wisecrack, or you can click the link down in the show notes. All right, back to the show. All right, so now we're going to start unpacking this film per the usual, but I do want to give a reminder that we are live on YouTube, so if you've got comments, thoughts, contributions, please hit us up down in the chat. We will definitely be addressing that. And then, of course, if you've got longer form things, yeah, you can email us at movies@wisecrack.co, movies@wisecrack.co with any of your thoughts. Of course, we have a mailbag sesh at the end. All right, so first things first, Riley, we already cracked the can a little bit on is it hashtag problematic, so let's talk about Hank Azaria.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Okay, so go ahead. What do we think? Like, when you mentioned Hank Azaria, you almost seemed a little bit like, oh, shit, that's a whole can of worms. So let's open the can.
It is. I mean, it's like, it is, you know, I remember watching it when I was younger and just being so entertained. And, you know, so this movie came out the year I was born. So it's like, again, I was born when The Birdcage came out. And I remember, like, being younger and just, like, you know, he's super funny, super entertaining. And then watching it, and especially now, you know, again, it was the 90s. And, like, we all should have been like, okay. But what learning, actually, I was telling you guys this a little bit before we started recording, but I was learning more about La Cage aux Folles, the 70s French film. And I didn't know, because I haven't seen that original film, but apparently the maid in the original was played by a black actor. But then as they were casting this, I don't know. And if you guys know this, I apologize for people who don't know. I'm just going to tell the story of like how Hank Azaria how that role came to be, in that Mike Nichols saw him in something and he's like, you know, do you want to be in this film? And we're doing a table read. Like, you can pick any small part you want to do. We'd love to have you be part of this project. And so when he did a reading, he's like, oh, I'll read the stage manager role. But then he added this like caricature-y accent to the stage manager role for some reason, and everyone thought it was very funny. And so then he just kind of, I think, read a bunch of small parts, and Agador was a much smaller role. It was like, he was like in one scene in the original version of the script, but they just loved like this quote, like big quotes, this take on Agador. And so they're like, and so then Elaine May went and like did a whole rewrite and made his part much larger. And they're like, we want you to be
Agador Spartacus. What a great fucking name.
An incredible name. But it is, I mean, it's a lot of people. It's so funny because it's like, I actually didn't realize till I mean, like, you know, years later when I was older, that Hank Azaria is a white dude. I didn't know that. And then I remember learning that. I'm like, oh, no. And then it's like, you know, he even has a line of like, you know, he's asking like, why aren't you going to put me in the show? And he's like, am I too primitive? And I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ. Like, it's tough.
Okay, let me ask a broader question about this tendency then. Like, I'm thinking of Hank Azaria, who also obviously famously is Apu on Simpsons, or was, I should say. And I'm thinking of like, back in the day, can we say back in the day for 25 years ago? Back in the day, you used to have character actors that would do this. And I'm thinking of another character actor that does this a lot, Alfred Molina, who Alfred Molina has played a Spaniard. He has played Middle Eastern. He's played, people of European descent. So what I wonder is are we in an age where like that type of character actor no longer exists? Because it used to be a sort of badge of honor if you could do these other accents and, you know, kind of like move in between. If you had maybe a look about you that would kind of fit between, you know, you could do Latino, or you could do like Middle Eastern, like I said, or something like that. So is that type of character actor, is that gone? And now it's going to be much more precise about the roles that you can fit into?
I think it's like, you know, I think what the industry has come to realize is that roles and people who are not white aren't just like characters, they're people. And so it's like, you know, instead of like Hank Azaria being like, oh, I'm going to be this Guatemalan character, it's we're not doing caricatures of non-white people anymore. And so it's like, and we shouldn't have been. And so it's like to have these actors who, I didn't know Alfred Molina had done all those kinds of roles, but it's like, you know, it's with Apu, with Agador Spartacus, it's like, it's, you know, it was almost just like a bit, I mean, I'm thinking this is like very extreme, but also Agador Spartacus is very extreme, of like Mickey Rooney in Breakfast at Tiffany's. It's like, people are like, oh, Mickey Rooney is like a big character actor, and he just is like this unbelievably grotesquely racist part in Breakfast at Tiffany's. But like, it was not really, you know, people watch that and they're like, oh, he's so fun. And it's like, my God, it's like, if this was extreme, that was on another level. And so, but that was in what, like the 60s? And this was in the 90s. And it's only like now that it's like, oh, maybe we shouldn't do that. Maybe that's not a badge of honor to do that anymore.
Yeah. Ryan, what do you think about this whole, the character actor thing? Is it a thing anymore?
Well, it's a weird subject, because like, I mean, no, obviously I think that it's not in vogue now, you know, but Nathan Lane, I was trying to find this article that that Nathan Lane was interviewing, and you know, he's on the record as saying like, look, like in his opinion, you know, he says his whole career would be very limited if he was just you know, if he was only playing gay characters and stuff, you know, or which I guess is the opposite, you know, if like is a straight, and he was talking about how Mark Ruffalo was perfect for this role, I think, where he had AIDS or something and played a gay man, and how awesome that, you know, his performance was. And he thinks that that's one of the beauties of acting. So, I mean, I see that point of view, but I also, you know, but then there's this, I think it's two conversations. It's the nature of acting, which is embodying another person and stuff. But then there's also this whole other conversation of representation. And it's like, all right, well, you have this big Hollywood movie, and yeah, you know, out of, there's a million, you know, gay people that could have played this role that are actors, but you went and found, you know, somebody who wasn't and went out of your way to, and then also on top of that made them way over the top. So yeah, I get both sides of that argument in a weird way. And I don't, you know, to me, it's one of those things where if it works, it works sometimes. And whether it's right or wrong, I don't know. I'm not here. I can't show you that meaning on this podcast.
A friend of mine posted something on Insta recently, and it was an interview with someone, and I don't remember who it was, but it was a gay actor. And he was saying, like, if you look at all the gay icons, Harvey Milk, things like that, they haven't been played by gay actors. They've been played by, you know, straight actors. A lot of times this happens. And he was like, it's a lot of actors don't come out in Hollywood because when you come out, you get cast as the gay character. Rather than being like, yeah, I'm gay, but can you just fucking cast me as the dad, or cast me as the guy, or cast me as the person, the fire person, or whatever the fuck it is. Like, just cast me. It doesn't have to be you're casting me as the gay friend all the time. And a lot of times that does kind of hamstring a lot of people in their abilities to actually engage in this artistic craft. So there is like a lot of stuff going on here. And I will say, like, I mean, I recently was auditioning for a play, a Sarah Kane play, which she's one of my favorite playwrights ever, if you know Sarah Kane. It was a play called Cleansed. Anyway, there are a lot of, like, there's, like, trans characters, there's queer characters in the play. And when I was sitting down with the director, they were talking to me about one role, but then they were like, look, if for some reason we find you fitting for another role, would you be interested? And then he said, but first, do you identify as queer? And I was like, I actually loved it, because it's this really, like, reputable theater company that is trying to make sure that they are elaborately expressing and representing adequate to what the script demands. And I was like, listen, I was like, I don't identify as queer. I've never lived as a queer man. I was like, it wouldn't even be fair for me, even if I could say in all my philosophical, and we had like a lovely philosophical chat about how I think everybody is actually queer and I don't believe in, you know, whatever, and in binaries instead. Like, I was like, but I've never lived that. I don't carry that weight at all. And I have not lived in that community. And so I was like, it wouldn't even be fair for me to do it. And he's like, that's wonderful. That's great. And so stuff like that, I think, is actually really important. And I don't know. I kind of feel like, if it goes for like a straight actor playing a gay role, I feel like that's vastly different than a gay actor playing a straight role, because we have decades and decades and decades where we've been able to do that as a straight man, where I've been able to play the gay role, but it hasn't worked the opposite way. And so I'm kind of like, you know what? Even if it tilts the pendulum a little bit in the opposite direction, I'm kind of okay with that for now, taking a step back, as we say in activist circles, right? I'm kind of okay with taking a step back a little bit. I don't know. It doesn't really bother me too much. I don't know. Yeah. Riley, you're an actor.
I am.
You vibe with that?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it's like representation fucking matters. Like, you know, I actually saw a wonderful clip from the Sarah Silverman podcast, the Sarah Silverman Show today, about non-Jewish actors playing Jewish roles and how, like, she's like, you know, with these, you know, for example, like Catherine Hahn is going to play Joan Rivers, and like with Rachel Brosnahan is Maisel, and, you know, XYZ, on and on and on. Like, she's like, you know, these actors aren't doing anything wrong, but you have all of, similarly with like all these big gay icons, you have all these like, especially like iconic like Jewish roles for Jewish women all being played by non-Jewish actors, and that it's like, you know, that's one thing when it's like, oh, just being Jewish is part of who they are, but then it's another thing that's like, it's like being Jewish is their life, that's like their identity, they really live in like, I am a Jewish woman, and for it to consistently not be played by any Jewish women is, you know, she's like, that's just frustrating. Especially, she's like, you know, then it's like, sometimes people get into the stereotype of like, a kind of like New York-y accent or like heightened things, you know, maybe like heightened like Yiddish or whatever. She's like, it's just really frustrating. And so she's like, I'm not saying, she's like, cause then she also said the same thing. She's like, yes, we're acting, but also, especially right now, representation really, really matters. And I would love to see more Jewish women playing Jewish roles. And so it's the same kind of thing. You know, it's like if an actor, like especially, you know, with all these like you were saying, that it's like coming out can really like hamstring you. It's like, oh, well, now I'm going to be typecast as XYZ. That doesn't happen with straight actors.
That's right.
It's not like, oh, well, I'm straight, so I'm only going to be playing these straight roles. Like that's not, that doesn't happen. And so it's like, yeah. We got to change some shit.
You know, speaking of casting, so apparently it was supposed to originally be Steve Martin as Armand. And then Robin Williams was supposed to play Albert, but Robin Williams had just come off of doing Mrs. Doubtfire, and he was like, I'd rather play a more subdued character. Can you imagine if it was Steve Martin and Robin Williams? It would have, I mean, one, just a different comedy dynamic, but I think the fact that Nathan Lane comes in there, who is a queer man himself also, I think it actually adds a lot of, well, you were talking about like the humanity of it, the sensitivity, even though Robin Williams is a brilliant actor, and I'm not saying that he wouldn't have been able to like bring the pathos. I'm sure he would have. There's something about the way that the casting works here that, and just Robin Williams as the kind of subdued. I love watching Robin Williams as the non-zany character. I love him in those roles. But so that's kind of really interesting too. That was it a scheduling conflict or what was it that caused the shift?
I was just listening to Nathan Lane talk about this. In that Robin Williams was like, I just came off doing Mrs. Doubtfire. I don't want to do like back-to-back drag roles. And he was more interested in playing like the straight man. And then Mike Nichols saw Nathan Lane in a Neil Simon play, and he went and he like approached him after the show. Mm. And Nathan Lane talks about how, like, before the show started, he looked out into the house and saw Mike Nichols and was like, oh, fuck me. And he approached him and he's like, hey, I'm doing this film. And he's like, it's, I'm directing, Elaine May wrote it, Robin Williams, Gene Hackman, are you in? And he's like, oh,
I'm in.
What are you talking? Was that even a question? And so it was, he's like, I want Nathan Lane to do it. But then Nathan Lane was like, there's a scheduling conflict because he was set to do the revival of A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum around the same time that filming was supposed to start. And so he had to pull out of The Birdcage. He's like, I can't do this anymore. I'm contractually obligated to be in this other thing that I agreed to before this. And so they started looking for different people to play Albert. But Mike Nichols kept coming back to Nathan Lane. He's like, I just can't. It's you. Like, it's no one but you. Is there any way you can move your schedule around? And so they made it work. And I think it's just, I mean, especially like to be, because this was the role that launched Nathan Lane's film career. I mean, he was already like a very well-known, like, you know, Broadway actor. But like to be, you know, the fact that both Robin Williams and Mike Nichols they weren't pushing to have like another big movie star at that time, that they're like, you know, and Robin Williams, who was already mega famous then, to put Nathan Lane, like a much less known actor in terms of like the Hollywood world, up with Robin Williams in like this queer film in the 90s, like that was such a huge gamble that like that I think that was just such faith in the casting and the story and everything about it that then just like launched Nathan Lane.
Then he got Mouse Hunt after this. And that, yeah. That really solidified his career in Hollywood.
I loved Mouse Hunt. Come on. Hey, Ryan, what is your, I mean, since we're kind of talking about a little bit, at least here, tangentially, we're talking about Mike Nichols here. Oh, yeah. I mean, Mike Nichols is known not only as being a great director, but one of the reasons he's known as being a great director is for getting the best performances out of people.
Well, I mean, he's one right? of the granddaddies so what, of improv too, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, he and Elaine May had an improv duo, a comedy duo together for years on Broadway. That was Elaine and that was Nichols and May. So, yeah, absolutely. He's a Second City guy from what I remember. Is
I
that right?
Believe you're right.
I think he was a Second City guy.
I don't know.
Yeah, Second City in Chicago. So, so we're talking about like building the foundations of what we understand as contemporary comedy today, right? So, but what do you think? What do you think about Mike Nichols?
I mean, I clearly love the shit out of him, and he. I mean, obviously, okay. The Graduate was such a big movie at the time. It not only, you know, if anyone who hasn't seen it, it just, it has, for one, a Simon and Garfunkel soundtrack was like the biggest soundtrack of the world
Great.
At that time.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, really, it's one of those generational films, people call it. It encapsulates kind of a feeling people had at a time, which you don't have very many of those in any given generation. I put maybe like Fight Club for the 90s is one of those or something, where it just kind of, you get a feeling of a whole mindset. And he's just great at that, you know, and that takes a humanist sensibility, you'd call it. But his first big, huge movie that was awesome that we got to mention, too, is Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Yeah.
Which is just like
That's
a
right.
black and white, like two-person melodramatic play almost put to film. It's awesome. If you're like a up-and-coming filmmaker, definitely go out of your way to watch Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. You can just see how, you know, if you get good actors and a good script, what you can do is super little. You know, it's just filmed in a house and two people doing it. It's great. I want to say there's one other big movie that he made that I love, Postcards from the Edge, with Melanie Griffith and Meryl Streep about Carrie Fisher, I think, from Star Wars, and just how her like a messed up childhood or growing up with a mom who's a drug addict. If that's a great movie too. I mean, yeah, all of his movies, like I said at the beginning, just are so different, but also are kind of these great character studies with really cool camera work and great scripts. So that's what I think about Mike Nichols.
What do we think about the performances in this then? I mean, obviously we talked about the Hank Azaria performance, but you know, Riley was talking about, you know, the Nathan Lane character that everybody talks about in all the reviews about how it's big. It's a very big performance, but there's also those moments of just intense groundedness, for lack of a better term. And so the question is what is this film exploring through this type of performance? Is it that somebody is... Go ahead,
I was just
going
to say, it's a satire, obviously. And I think I would put it akin to is South Park, right? Which to me has very obviously insane characters and predicaments and situations, but also has a grounded heart at the center of it that makes you care about all this crazy shit. It's like, wow, you know, sometimes you're like, this stuff is so insane. I can't believe I give a shit about this stupid situation that it's in. So I think that he was going for a vibe that was very much making fun of the times of the 90s, you know, the kind of stuffy, like you said, Tipper Gore conservative, like, we got to save the children aspect, you know, we got to save the children from all these gay people, you know, we can't expose them to that. Like that, you know, which was, you know, there was rampant homophobia in the 90s. I mean, that from as someone who like, you know, grew up there, I just remember that being, there was a shift in the culture that I've witnessed in my lifetime of, you know, people calling kids gay and stuff at school and were way worse than that. And then to now how like that kid that would say that would just be run out of school, you know, and that's a good thing, you know. So like that's been, so I think that this movie is a time of that period where, you know, Will and Grace was this big subversive show in the 90s because, oh, wow, that, you know, they have gay characters who weren't gay, you know, at the end of the day. But wow, it was groundbreaking for just them even, you know, putting that on a network TV. So this is, I think, the same effect, which is just we're going to make this hardcore satire about, you know, the conservatives and even the gay community too. But then also what's cool about it is that I feel like if you made that movie today, you would just go so hard on the conservative right or something to make it, it would basically just be like, look at these fucking stupid idiots at the end of the day. And you know, mm-hmm. how much smarter we are. Whereas I think this, what's good about Mike Nichols is he makes fun of them, but also, you know, Gene Hackman's a, you know, a human character at the end, and he learns something, and it at least shows that the people are human and can learn and grow, as opposed to being these just only buffoons that need to be taken down a notch, you know, and we're gonna, you know, stick it to them,
right? Kind of vibe. Because it's like, it's, that's such a big theme, but that's not the heart of the story. The heart of the story is about like family and like what yeah. relationships do you value, and like who are you, and you're, you know, it's 100%.
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm thinking about what is Gene Hackman's character? Like, is he a stereotype, or is he a caricature, or is he a pretty good embodiment of an ultra conservative Christian who is a part of like the moral majority that grew up in the late 70s and 80s, you know, Pat Buchanan listening. I mean, at one point he's like, he gets all excited because Nathan Lane says something. He's like, oh my God, Rush Limbaugh yeah, said that. So yeah. it's like a Rush Limbaugh listening. And a lot of the names that he drops are like 90s politicians right. or 90s pop culture. He says like Billy Graham is too progressive yeah. at one point. I'm like, okay. I'm like, that's fucking hilarious, right? So the question is he written with a sensitivity where he's still human, or is he too much of a caricature? Now, I grew up in an evangelical environment. I went for my bachelor's degree to a hyper-conservative evangelical university. My father is still a hyper-evangelical Baptist. So I have been in this environment. I have dated people in this world. I have gone to church with people in this world. He's pretty spot on. And I don't think it's like poorly represented. The problem is it might seem like he's the bad guy because that's how it's pitched in this film, obviously. But I don't think it's done unfairly. I think it's a pretty good representation of a certain type of political conservative in the United States. And then I think with Nathan Lane, like, yeah, there's a little bit of an over-the-top performance, but at the same time, there is such the humanity when Nathan, what's Nathan's Albert. Character? I totally forgot. Albert. When Albert sits there and is like wearing the pink socks after
oh he's, my God. Yep. That's right? the one that he's makes done me cry this amazing, every single time.
He's done a great Ugh. Job of passing as straight, and then he sits there and he corrects how he's sitting and he fumbles a little bit, and then he's got pink socks mm-hmm. on, and it's like, I'm doing my fucking best, but I just had to have a little bit of a pop, right? Don't we have a little bit of a color accent? And they look at him like they're disappointed in him, and he is crushed. And at that point you're like, okay, so this person is not a caricature. This person is not some sort of persona, but this person has layers and layers mm-hmm. in depth, right? And that scene is very tragic and heartbreaking.
That is my favorite scene in the entire movie. That, just like the shot of him coming in the door. I mean, for just the acting in those like 2 minutes alone without saying a word of like him coming in. He starts yeah. walking how he naturally does and then stops himself and like is trying so hard, sits, crosses, like readjusts. I just, my heart yeah, yeah. breaks every single time. And it's like, because then, oh my God, he's like, I so badly wanted to impress you and wanted to, you know, help you. Mm. But then of course you still get the laugh when it's like, it's so grounded. And then he just goes, but you hate me. You both hate yeah. me. And then he leaves. And it's like, and then it just like that still makes me, like, it makes me cry, it makes me laugh. That moment. And then the scene of him and Robin Williams bus stop where he's like, I'm going to the cemetery with my toothbrush. And then he, Robin Williams meets him there and he gives him the palimony agreement. And the two of them just like really recommitting to each other. And that moment, it, like just those moments in the whirlwind of like how broad this is, those ground the whole film for me. And then like when Robin Williams tells Val, the son, who I think is the main villain of the movie, Val sucks, but when oh my God, he sucks, but when he tells,
yeah, the fact that he put his that he put his family in that position in the horrible. First place is super shitty.
Horrible.
Yeah.
Like
so shitty.
Like, we know Gene Hackman's an asshole. We know he's an idiot. We know he sucks.
But he's in love.
Like he's ruining everyone's life. He is, like, it's just ridiculous. But it's like when he's Robin Williams, like when he's first, you know, when like they're redoing, or when he's telling him that they need to redo the whole house, and Robin Williams is like, "What are you talking about? Like, no, like this is art. Like, what do you mean?" And then he like he like smears the foundation off of his face, puts it on the wall.
Oh, that's fucked.
And then he's like, "You just need to send Albert away." And he's like, "What the fuck?" And Robin Williams is about to leave, and he's like, "I know who, at least like I know who I am. Like, fuck the senator. I don't care what he thinks."
Like, yeah, that was a good scene.
Oh, fantastic. Val is the villain of the movie. He is a piece of shit.
Can I say, like when I think of this movie, a scene, I wouldn't say it's my favorite scene, but it's such a subversive shot, and I can just see Mike Nichols laughing while he's editing it, is when Val's introduced to the movie. And, you know, you've been introduced to Robin Williams, Val comes in, he's this young hunk, and you, like, think that Robin Williams is gonna, is just, like, his boy toy,
and it's
his son, you know?
Yeah.
And, like,
but brilliant.
He totally makes you like. He makes you
even the way
that
he touches his chin
in such a crazy way.
Yes.
Even the way he touches his chin.
Hair, fantastic. Oh, it was such a brilliant intro. Oh, and
so
then, you know, like having the different. It's like you have the white wine chilling in the fridge. I only drink red, and so do you. Oh, I mean, like that first. Just in terms of performance, that first, the first scene between Albert and Armand, when Nathan Lane's getting ready and refuses to go on stage, that is in my some of the funniest shit I've ever seen in my life. Oh my god.
Okay, then let's talk real quick. Favorite scenes, favorite sequences. Is there a moment where, I mean, you just did, Riley, it's the one where Albert comes in
socks.
Wearing the suit. Pink socks. Yeah. Ryan, is there a favorite sequence? Is there something that stands out? Like, now that you've just watched it kind of on like a refresher, is there something the next time someone says the birdcage that's going to fucking stand out most to you?
It was the ones I've already said, with Gene Hackman singing We Are Family and just how tender of a funny, weird moment that is. And then the one we just talked about where Val all of a sudden his son. But then I will also mention just the opening shot and like the drone in on the birdcage. That's an with We Are Family playing. Mm-hmm. That's a fun intro to a movie, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, you're just, it gets you pumped. I guess it, you know, obviously using that song is cheating because it's so fun, but it's great.
And real quick, I want to jump in. Together. I want to jump into the chat real quick. I don't know if it's, I think it's supposed to be Dread Angel, but it's DR3AD_ANG3 and then L. So I'm assuming it's Dread Angel. Says, are they serious when they say straight people don't get typecast? I was saying, and I think what Riley was saying, not that straight people don't get typecast, but don't get typecast as straight.
So
it's not that you become the straight guy. That doesn't mean that like if you're The Rock and you're like macho as fuck, that no one is ever going to be like, oh, he like that people don't think automatically of like a kind of like stereotypical masculine straight dude. Sure, possibly, and maybe he is typecast in certain ways, but I think the idea was is more about your identity position in society. I think what we were talking about, Riley, is that
Yeah, I mean, it's like there's a difference between, it's like, oh, you're typecast as like the nerd or like the best friend,
right?
Or, you know, the popular girl. But that's nothing to do with like with you know, being gay,
your core
or straight,
identity,
or,
right?
Or
right.
Your core identity, anything about that? Yeah.
Okay, and then real quick, Anonymous says, "Hey, Wisecrack, your videos inspired me to declare philosophy as my major. Thanks, a-holes." Well, first I want to say, yes, I apologize, and you're welcome at the same time. And then secondly, JK, but any advice coming out to my parents as a philosophy major? Don't. Just say that you're doing law, and then...
What? That's your advice?
Say you're doing English or something. Yeah, you're doing English literate. No, I'm kidding. Just say it. Philosophy is one of the most hireable professions because they score consistently. Philosophy majors score consistently across the board on the tests at an average clip, at a higher rate than every other major. Philosophy is becoming more important these days in terms of like tech ethics and technology. But if you're going to do philosophy, definitely try to do something that's also more hands-on, maybe like computer engineering as a minor, something where you can do, where you can put yourself in into the market, and I hate speaking like this as a radical lefty. It hurts my heart to say to condescend to the market, but condescend to the market by doing tech ethics or, like, you know, being work do work on, like, digital management or communications or something like that, and then that'll help. But do it. Philosophy's a great major. So, okay. So a couple things I did want to ask. This is a farce. And we talked a little bit about how it's like satire and it's kind of slapstick and over the top. And I was wondering, I don't think you can make a farce in 2021, 2022.
Can you remind me the definition of that word? Because I know that that and satire are different, but it's like, give me an example.
Well, so like satire is like an intentional effort to draw attention to like contradictions in society, right? It's meant to mimic and kind of expose certain elements of a culture, society, subculture, whatever. A farce tends to use physical comedy, slapstick, and things like that. So it's a little bit more, I would almost kind of call like an innocent form of comedy. A lot of physical comedy, like one of the most famous plays, and they did, I think John Ritter was in a film adaptation of it. It's called Noises Off. It's like people coming in and out of doors at the same time. Like, I'm looking for Ryan, Ryan's looking for Riley, and I come into a door and I'm like, Ryan, have you seen Riley? And you're like, no, I'm looking for her. And I'm like, oh, I just saw her. She went around this corner, and then I go in this way, and then Riley comes up to me, and Riley's like, oh, Riley, have you seen? Or Riley's like, Austin, have you seen Ryan? And I'm like, and then like the phone rings, and I pick up the phone, and then it's Grandma, and Grandma is like, oh, Riley, hold on one second. And then like you step out, and then Ryan comes in right at that moment. It's like that. It's kind of like silly, goofy, a little bit more physical comedy, really fast and snappy, and things like that.
I'm realizing that what I do in my videos is a farce, apparently.
You definitely have farcical elements, a farcician. But like, do you think we can make these stuff? Like, are we too jaded? Like, I was wondering, like, are we too, like, we've gone through ironic detachment and farce is no longer funny for us because we need like heavy hitting things.
Interesting.
And if it's
yeah.
and if it's just Hank Azaria tripping in the kitchen and falling over, we don't laugh at that anymore.
Oh my God. I disagree. I think that farces are exactly what we need right now, and everyone's looking for a good old just simple mm-hmm. laugh, you know, at least with their entertainment, not like everything, you know, they don't have to take anything seriously. But for some things, they would like to just, yes, let's laugh at each other and have a good old time and no one take it too seriously. Is, I think, a desire in way more people's minds than it probably comes off as. But you're right. It is hard, and it's hard to do it right. And it's, so yeah. What do y'all think?
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. God, I love a farce. I mean, it's like this, this, especially just thinking of Birdcage specifically, it's like, you know, for me, a classic farce is like the dinner party gone wrong, and you know, like this, and it feels very Molière. It feels very like, you know, like it's just like such a classical form of storytelling and of comedy. And I think like when done well, because I've seen some farces that are like, you know, even I've seen like Molière done like Tartuffe done not great. But like when farce is done well, it's kick ass and it's so funny. Like, but it's like to find that sweet spot. And I think that's for me why this movie works so well. It's like you have the farce, you have the big broad comedy, but you have the heart to it. And I think like if there isn't for me at least, if there isn't the heart, then it's not funny. Cause then I'm watching it just for a cheap laugh. Which is fine, and that's
the point.
Yeah,
it's fun. And the person in the chat, Tim's, just brought up that Airplane is the most famous farce. Airplane mm-hmm. was such a big movie in my life.
All the Naked Gun movies.
I had never laughed harder in my life than when I first saw Airplane at the time. And would you argue, Riley, that does that movie have heart to it? You know, do you think of heart when you think of Airplane? I mean, it is a great time. Yeah. You can't argue that, I don't think, but.
Yeah, I get it's like for, you know, and this is just now, not even thinking about farce, but just comedy in general. It's like at least my sensibilities, I don't like mean comedy. I don't like comedy that's like shitting on other people. I think that's a really cheap form of comedy and I'm not about it. It's not funny to me.
And if you want an example of Riley's sensibility of comedy, go to her comedy, go to her Twitter page, and there's a gummy bear conversation that she has that is her pinned tweet. And in this gummy bear conversation, there is nothing mean. There is no mean comedy. It is wholesome as fuck.
I am not a wholesome comic by any means, but like comedy that's just insult comedy, you know, it's so easy and that's so boring to me. And yes. So something like a farce or satire or whatever, it's like there, and with Airplane's so fucking smart. Like it's so brilliant. And I guess it doesn't need to have heart. I mean, God, but could you do Airplane now? Like, would people care about making something like Airplane now?
Well, that there was those whole, what, like, disaster movie, date movie people forever, right, that were cranking them out, and everyone was like, all right.
But is a spoof the same as a farce?
Yeah, those were spoofs. Like, Airplane wasn't a spoof of anything else.
Well, no, it was a spoof of the Airplane disaster movies that were kind of popular
and
at that
time. Naked Gun is a spoof of the spy movies. And but it's kind
Austin
of
Powers is a spoof of like James Bond.
Yeah. This is good. Yeah, if people are
that's
fucking
really interesting
comedy
I've never
theorists.
About this.
Yeah, I know. The difference between a spoof and a farce, and has the age of the farce is it gone? Yeah. Okay. So because this podcast
I hope not
is called
It's too good.
It is good. Because it's called Show Me the Meaning, I got one thing that I definitely have to bring up. And mm-hmm. I don't know if you noticed it, but so there's a bit where Armand goes to visit Val's mother, and Albert comes with, and Albert's waiting in the waiting room of this office space, and the secretary is reading, and the secretary is reading Nietzsche.
Mm-hmm.
Now, clearly that's a choice that Mike Nichols is like, you are reading a book by Nietzsche. It could have been anything. Why Nietzsche? And does it have something to do with the change of the title from in the French, it's translated into English as like the crazy cage, right, to the bird cage? And I have an idea, and I found a quote from Nietzsche where he talks about a bird being let free, right? And so Nietzsche's famous for like the death of God, that, you know, the structures that once kind of told us or destined us to live certain ways, that's kind of fallen apart. But nevertheless, the shadow is still cast on us and we still live as though there's some sort of structure. And then, of course, how terrifying it is to realize that we don't have any structure that's grounding us, but that there's just like this unbounded potency of freedom, right? And so here's a small little quote where he says, "Oh, the poor bird that felt itself free and now strikes against the walls of this cage." So is there something about the title of The Bird Cage as being like restriction in society? And are Armand and Albert, are they birds that are trapped in this cage? But then once freedom is opened, there's that difficulty of flying. And what does that mean to be free? And what do we think? Like, is there something there? Am I reading too much into this? Is there something about the title of The Bird Cage that's important about freedom and not being shackled by like the bars of society? Or is it just cool because in a bird cage, you can kind of stand there and you can do like a cool pole dance in between the bars, and that's the name of the and that's the name of the nightclub? Like, what do we think?
I mean, like, oh, you go, Ryan, you go.
Oh no, I was going to say I was hoping Austin first to show me the Nietzsche meeting in that, because I was wondering the same thing. Riley, what was your take?
That's so interesting. I mean, like, I think, I mean, again, I'm going to come back to my take as Val being the villain of this film, in that it's like Albert and Armand were free at the beginning, and then Val put them in that goddamn cage and like made a cage out of their home, like fully redecorated it. Like, you know, it just, he put that on them, and he, you know, he was saying like, well, it's because of the center, it's because of all this. And it's like, well, you're the one doing it. It's like, they didn't care. It's like they or not they, I mean, like Albert and Armand, like they're like, fuck what he thinks, like,
yeah,
I know who I am, I'm not gonna that's bullshit. But right. Val is the one putting that on them, and so it's really, it's just, you know, it's like in this theme of family and Like for the family member to be the one who puts you in that cage, to, for the family member, for like your son to be the one who's like, well, because I love this person so much, I'm gonna, you know, like almost break the entire family, bring them down and restrict it in such a way that it could all fall apart for my own needs.
Yeah, that is an interesting, I think you just showed everyone the meaning there, Riley. Thank you very much. but it is funny when you think about it, how just the love quadrangle, or however you want to call it, like everyone is doing something because they love the other person and getting the other person that they love to do something because of it. Like, you know, and so at the end of the day, you know, obviously it starts with how rigid Gene Hackman's character is, but you're right. Other people along the way could have put their foot down and said, no, this isn't right. But they all did it because they loved another person, and that's just a beautiful, beautiful thing.
It's like throughout, it's you know, it's family, it's all these relationships. It's like, what do you value? Who do you like? What relationships do you value, or like what is important to, what is the most important thing to you? And so, I mean, there's even a moment where like Robin Williams says it very clearly, you know, when he's telling Val that like that Albert is gonna stay and try and play it straight or whatever, and he's not gonna go away, and Val's like, what the fuck, and he's like, it came down to Albert or your mother, and I chose Albert. Like it was it's that simple, and like Val can't really wrap his head around that, and but then like, you know, he ends up telling his birth mom to come, and so then it's like that who he doesn't know, who he hadn't met until that night, and so it's like that idea of him having this nuclear hetero family was more important to him than his actual like parent. And so it just, it's like, it's just watching, especially for Val, it's like all these different shifting priorities and shifting relationships. Whereas like for Albert and Armand, like Albert, I think it has the purest sense of like, I love my family. I'm going to do, you know, whatever they need, even though it's going to hurt me. And so it's like he'll leave, he'll try and play straight Uncle Al. How about that whole sequence is great too. I'm just like, how about them dolphins? And then like walk, you know, it's like you pierce the toes, that whole thing. And that, or then, you know, coming in drag as Catherine is him being like, I love you so much, I value you, so I'm gonna do this for you, even though it's like Val's worst nightmare,
right?
Yeah,
but he does come in and saves the day, doesn't he? So,
oh my God. And then all the shit that he said, you know, as he's like playing along, that scene is great too, of like him talking to Gene Hackman at dinner and just like just spewing out all of these like grotesque, hyper conservative talking points, and Hackman like eating it up, and Val just being like, "You shouldn't talk about things you don't know about," and Gene Hackman's like, "Your mother's a very intelligent woman."
yes.
So good.
All right, I say we go ahead and wrap up the discussion there. It's a great freaking movie. It's one of those ones that, what did I read? I read, it was put as like, if you think about queer struggles as like laying down bricks, this film exists along this pathway that is still being constructed many miles back, but that its legacy is important and for what it does. So not only is it important maybe socially, culturally, but also it's fucking fun. The performances are great. The direction is great. Obviously, go check out Mike Nichols' filmography as well. So we'll go ahead and probably wrap the chat up there. And then what we got to do now, of course, is we got to dip into the mailbag real quick.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Welcome to the Snapple Market Auditory Experience. Close your eyes. Imagine you're walking into your neighborhood store. You make your way to the back and reach for your favorite Snapple flavor. You can't wait. You take a sip. Whoa, that's a lot of flavor. What flavor are you holding? Now open your eyes and check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavorful Snapple near you.
So if y'all out there have thoughts about The Birdcage, about its lasting legacy, if you have thoughts about anything we talked about in the past, Nightcrawler, Pan's Labyrinth, fuck, we even talked about Mother in our inaugural episode. I don't give a shit. If you have thoughts about stuff we have covered, fucking email us at movies@wisecrack.co, or you can call us at 1-213-534-8807. That's 1-213-534-8807. You can leave us a little voicemail. We're going to turn to a voicemail right now. Roll it.
Hey, Wisecrack crew. This is Sterling from Illinois. I just finished your episode on Nightcrawler, and I'm going to keep this short. What do you guys think of the idea of Lou, the main character, as the embodiment of corporate personhood taken very literally? Thanks, y'all. Have a good day.
Okay, basically, is Lou like the embodiment of corporate America, right? Or like the embodiment of
corporate
the business?
Corporate personhood. Like Mitt Romney, like corporations are people, man. Like, is Jake Gyllenhaal the embodiment of the Mitt Romney, our corporations are people, man?
Is he a human or a corporation as human, essentially? Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Ryan?
No. Well, I mean, that's not what Mitt Romney meant by that. But in terms of it, like you could say, like, he's just driven to... for this just completely almost nihilistic, greedy, you know, drive that he has, and he'll do absolutely anything to get that. But corporations don't go around, you know, willingly murdering people and stuff. I guess you can make an argument.
What?
I'm just saying if they're going to do illegal things, they at least try to hide it more. I mean, which I guess this guy's getting away with it, so fuck, man. Maybe this analogy doesn't work at all and he's right. But yeah, I'd say that's the main difference. He literally says he hates people. Okay.
Yeah.
And so do corporations hate people? I mean, I guess they are completely driven by just making themselves bigger so they care
profits
about only
and
themselves.
Shareholder interest.
So, I mean, you can make that, you know, but usually, and then I guess you could say like they're trying to make their customers happy, which he is at the end of the day, like the people that he makes this stuff for, they are happy with his products. So he's just in a very, I would say, I guess, immoral or gray area morality industry, which you could name a whole handful of those as, like even like gambling or something, you know. Yeah, if is it good if you're a casino to be trying to get the worst, you know, addicts among us to come and waste all their money, and is that immoral for them to make money off of that? I mean, you know, that's a good question. Like so I put them in that category of corporate personhoods. What do y'all think? That's
Riley,
question.
Have you seen?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I haven't,
have you
but
seen
this
Nightcrawler?
This conversation is making me want to watch it. That's
it's
fascinating.
Really, oh, you gotta see
it's
it.
Really
it's
good.
Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of touched on it last week when we talked about the film. I think the best way to think about it is that what you get with Jake Gyllenhaal's character Lou is that he's not a person, right? I mean, we talked about the characteristics of psychopathy that he clearly exhibits, but I think even more than that, the reason, and then people also have done this
he's
with
the
okay,
fucking
our
devil.
Like, well, people have also said like our corporations. Persons in the legal sense, and if so, do they exhibit the characteristics of psychopathy? And there is actually some like sociological research that's saying, well, if corporations are persons, then they're psychopathic because they exhibit all these characteristics. But here's the thing I would say, without getting too much into that, you know, there's literature out there, fucking do the research, as the kids say these days. But what I would say is that Jake Gyllenhaal is clearly an embodiment of the institution that he's trying to impress, right? Which is why he's reading all those business books, which is why he uses those fucking self-help mantras. There's nothing authentic about him, and I think that would be the human element. The authenticity or the sincerity would be the human element, and that's not there because he's trying so hard to get ahead and to win because he's in that situation of desperation that he finds himself in, that I think his inhumanity comes across like he's just using corporate speak, and that's all he knows how to do. You know, he's thinking about like fucking the leverage position. That's why I don't want to say anything actually to spoil it for Riley, but that's why he does some of the things that he does, because he doesn't want somebody to potentially threat his leverage position. And he's worried about the quarter, and you know, the language that he uses is all just business speak. And so maybe he is just the embodiment of the institution that is what we call the corporation. But
well, I think you're totally right, but I also I do think it's important that in relation to the news, to news media, right? Like and how manipulative it is, right? And so I think that those two things together make the movie so interesting. All right.
Yeah. Great freaking movie. Check that shit out.
Thanks for the comment.
All right, so Yeah, definitely. Thanks for the comment. If you want to give us a call, you can 1-213-534-8807. That's 1-213-534-8807. And of course, you can email us movies@wisecrack.co. We are going to be doing, I believe, at some point, a mailbag episode, which we've done in the past. But there's so many emails that we have that we haven't been able to address, sometimes really long, thoughtful ones. So we're going to do a full segment or a full episode where we're just kind of like answering all of your questions and thoughts and insights and film recommendations or whatever. So we're going to kind of look through all those and present some of those in the coming month or so, let's say. We also want to give a shout out to our other podcasts at Culture Binge, The Squanch. Go check those things out. They're fucking great. And of course, we have to thank Riley for coming and joining us.
Thank you guys for having me and letting me just rant about this film.
This was a very interesting conversation.
I would have never chosen this film because I just wouldn't have thought about like it being like for our episode or for our show to like pull it apart. But I'm so fucking glad you did. That's why we need to kind of like look in places that would be unfamiliar maybe. But yeah, bring the farce is what I'm saying.
That's what I want to leave this being is like, let's keep the farces going.
Yeah.
Amen.
Because God, they're good.
And if you want to check out Riley, she's got a podcast that she does called Review Review. Riley, can you give us a little spiel? What are you guys doing on the podcast?
Sure can. It is a long-form improv-based podcast where we review just about anything from all the corners of the internet. We got Amazon, TripAdvisor, Yelp, etc. And I co-host that with Jeffrey James. So REVIEWREVUE on the HeadGum Network.
Sick. All right. And Ryan, where can people find you on the internet, brother?
Ryan Shorts on all the platforms. I had a piano lesson that I'm going to put up my piano lesson video. So with Jason D. Williams, the illegitimate son of Jerry Lee Lewis. Sick.
Is it farcical?
She probably wouldn't be happy that I said that. But anyway, that's what my video and my next one is about. Go check it out.
All right. And Riley, what about your socials? You got anything you can plug?
Oh, goodness. You can find me Riley Anspa on Instagram, REILLYANSPAUGH, and Riley Coyote on Twitter.
Awesome. I'm Austin Hayden. Find me on Twitter, Insta, all the places. You know the thing. Ryan, send us out, brother.
Everybody, we're Show Me the Meaning, yeah, with Austin, Ryan, and Riley, yeah, oh, we're Show Me the Meaning, woo, with Austin, Ryan, and Riley, see you later.